Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Infinite Potential podcast. It's been about 9 months since we've released one. We've had a lot going on, but we're going to ramp this bad boy back up. So thanks for joining us. Today, we have got, you're going to have to help me with your last name, Anthony.
Ugly.
Anthony has been my coach for the last few months, and I think he is definitely worthwhile an interview. The guy has got bags of knowledge, and I think he can be of great service to anyone listening. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Awesome. It's good to be here, mate.
Thank you very much. Tell us a little bit about you, what you do, where you come from, that sort of thing.
So there's two things behind what I do now. So originally I'm born from Barnsley, a small mining town in the north of England, which is known for, at least in my mind, as the place where you are most likely in the United Kingdom to born, live and die without ever going anywhere else, which speaks a lot to the mentality of the people there. So I always consider that whatever I achieve in life, I'm doing well considering the environment. So in terms of coaching, that kind of thing, I've always been into studying psychology, consciousness, leadership, personal development for about 20 years when I stumbled upon the work of Timothy Leary, Robert Anton Wilson, and was introduced to this idea of there being 8 stages of human development. And I thought to myself for a bunch of years, how do you put all of that into a system and a framework that you can lead people through that essentially can make an impact for people on all levels of how we show up and how we act in the world. Because, when I look in terms of most coaching that I see in the world is either very narrow focused and sort of remedial, which is fine to, it's nothing wrong with solving specific problems, but I guess my emphasis has always been on how can you make something holistic, grounded, well integrated, and take the best of practical, pragmatic, everyday knowledge, but also enable people to sort of raise their level of thinking, which is what ultimately solves our own problems and is of the greatest benefit to humanity. Cool. And then for me, I got really interested in sort of enlightenment, spirituality, that kind of thing. I used to go to sort of hardcore meditation things, Vipassana, all that stuff 20 odd years ago before mindfulness became a thing. I was doing it and I had no idea it was ever going to become popular. And I was in this in this retreat center, and the teacher said, maybe in 1,000 lifetimes, you'll be able to sit down and become enlightened. I just thought at the time, that just didn't sound true to me.
No.
I was like, hold on, that sounds like a belief system. What about this lifetime? Why can't we solve most of humanity's greatest problems in this lifetime? We've got the technology, we've got the information, we've got the knowledge. Why do we have to reincarnate another 100 times in order to get there?
Yeah. Cool. So you've gone down the road of integral psychology, would that be right?
So integral is one of the sort of the theories and the systems that's gone into creating the sort of Fresh Mind program. And so integral psychology is about integrating the physical with the spiritual, with the business, with environment, and trying to bring as much broad knowledge and synthesize that together into ways that, as I understand it, are as sort of pragmatic as possible. And then within Integral, you have things like spiral dynamics is fits within a lot of Integral approaches, which again looks at how human development goes through different stages of growth, and also how societal development goes through different stages of growth. So you can pretty much, you know, you can predict very well how people will think based on their environmental conditions.
Which is a very useful tool when communicating.
It's a very useful tool when you're communicating, absolutely. Yeah, and if, again, the more you can understand people's worldviews, and then you can understand the kind of language that they resonate with, then you can sort of adapt your language in order to fit with their worldview. And also, it helps to understand that, you know, some of the great principles of integral theory are certain things like, you know, everybody's right from their own point of view.
Yeah.
So it's very useful to, because everybody believes that they're right. So if you can go about not making people feel like they're wrong, you're off to a good start, and people are going to be much more open then to sort of a different perspective.
I mean, does that not bring in the argument of moral relativism, where there isn't an innate right and wrong, you sort of create it yourself?
It does, but that's silly, isn't it?
Explain, I don't know, man. That's what you're here for.
So I think in terms of your own worldview, you can have any worldview that you want, but an absolute truth is still absolute. So you know, you have absolute knowledge is the foundation of no knowledge, or the highest knowledge that there is, which is the knowledge of our divinity, or the knowledge of that we are infinite, and that infinity is beyond the personality, beyond the body. Beyond form.
I read something last night, and what was said last night was, we're going to use the label. We'll use the label God. God is everything.
Yeah.
So therefore, it can only be described negatively in order to realise what it isn't. Because as soon as it's manifested, it isn't what it is. So you can only get there by saying what it isn't.
That's certainly one way of viewing it. But I think there's also like a sort of positivist tantra way of looking at God, which is like wholly in the positive, but it's still, you know, it's useful to that, you know, to that thing. It's obvious that, you know, the word God is not God.
Correct. Yeah.
And you know, you often come back to like the, you know, the phrase from what's the film Princess Bride, where the guy says, "This word you say, God, I don't think it means what you think it means."
yeah, not a true word spoken.
Yeah, you know, because that's the, you know, ultimately when it comes to, you know, success, business, societies, governments, whatever, like the fundamental principles, if it's built on the principle and the knowledge of there is one life, then you're starting from the right foundations.
Yeah.
And generally building on top of those foundations, you're going to end up with sort of great success, great results, all these kind of things happen. And, you know, because you can have success without any sort of foundation in terms of absolute. And they're generally the people who get to that, they become their success, and then they go, "Oh, I'm not happy. Mm-hmm. I'm not fulfilled. I don't actually know how to enjoy myself. I've got all the stuff that I thought I wanted, that society said was good, that I've always thought I believed in, but there's no."
So what causes that friction within a person? So they've got everything they thought they'd want 10 years previous. They've set a path for themselves. They've got there. What is that friction that's still within them that needs releasing?
So I would say it comes down to have a lack of self-knowledge.
As in knowledge of self.
Knowledge of self.
Yes.
So you don't know who you are at a fundamental level beyond personality.
Yeah.
The second one is that is people often create success, and it's based on society's idea of what it means to be successful. So it's often based upon somebody else's definitions of what success really means. So you might be like, okay, so success means having this amount of money, this kind of lifestyle, this kind of thing. And you get there, you arrive there, and you go, wait a minute, what I've always wanted, but I've never given myself the opportunity, or I just haven't taken the time to discover it, or I simply didn't know a deep enough level that that was available to me.
Mm. Yeah. So what I find, especially in the like the conspiracy realms, which it seems to be like a level that you pass through. I can only speak from experience that sort of happened. Secret space programs and all this, that, the other, and you hear it all, but there seems to still be that innate knowing of what they are, which actually stops them progressing through that point in their life. And they're holding on to the negative all the time. Ah, that's happening. The Federal Reserve are controlling the money stream. This, that, the other. I could throw thousands out there. But it's that pinnacle that they're missing in order to transcend the way through it.
Yes, exactly. It's all sort of stuck at the level of the separate self, basically, which is... Yeah. You know, ultimately, the source of all humanity's problems is the belief in separation, which just can't be true. And then when, at least for me, my own experience of what we might say like enlightenment, awakening, self-knowledge is, you know, so like the deeper that I go into it, the more ordinary it becomes.
Yeah.
And I think also one of the issues is that there's a lot of this idea of spirituality that it's like it's really special and it's really unique and you have to be something in order to like access the divine. But if everything's divine, then
you don't have to do anything, essentially.
You don't have to do anything because it's always there. And I think there's... you know, this sense of, because people say, oh, you can never attain perfection. I'm like, you're right, but you can realize it. It's really easy.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it's that is, you know, perfect or, you know, wholeness is the essential nature of life because it's not dividable.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the essence of non-dual thought is that there aren't two, and no matter how you go about looking for that in your awareness, in your inquiry, in your discovery, you'll never find more than one. It's not possible.
Yeah, like that which is aware of everything is the same in everybody.
Yes,
the awareness is always the same no matter what situation anybody's in. Was it the lady that is now called, is it Ganjaji, the blonde-haired lady?
Oh, yeah.
And I think I might be still corrected, but I think she was being raped and she just completely stopped resisting the experience itself. And that was when she had that instantaneous awakening, if that's the term you want to use. As soon as you stop resisting the perfectness of everythingness, that is when magic happens.
Yes.
Mm. Thanks for that. That was a very well put. Let's look at the term you've used, mindfulness. You've used twice. Is mindfulness not mindlessness?
Yes.
What a complete upside down phrase. Yeah, makes no sense.
Well, it makes no sense. And... also, it it makes, it's like, it's one of those things that it's nonsense and it makes sense. Because it's like I was talking to a friend the other day who was over from Australia, and he's like running like some yoga centers and this kind of stuff. And they were talking about, we were talking about like level one awareness of anxiety, which is what basically the majority of mindfulness practice that is out there in the world is about, like level one anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, so you use Headspace to get calm. You use, a meditation app to get calm, to clear out anxiety. So, but what that's supposed to do, so what that mindfulness is supposed to do is create a sense of a foundation for you to actually do the proper meditation and inquiry, which is to start to see that the mind is the thing that creates most of your problems.
Mm.
And if you can then, you know, so I talk about this with clients in Fresh Mind. You say, okay, it's great. You've got anxiety. Well, you've got three reasons for being anxious, right? One, you're out of alignment with your mission, your purpose, your vision, that essence of who you are and what you're on this planet to do in this body. So, and that anxiety is a message telling you need to adjust something.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you have, there are situations in your world, in your business, your relationship, your health, and that anxiety is giving you a message that you need to resolve those problems and take action. And if you sit or listen to that anxiety for long enough or with the right guidance or support, you can then figure out the simple and obvious solutions to those complicated, anxious problems. Take action on it, anxiety gone.
Mm.
And then the other is conditioning, habit, etc. I see so many entrepreneurs perpetuating this idea that it's normal for entrepreneurs to feel loads of fear and anxiety and doubt and feel like they're not enough. And I'm like, well, it might be normal, but it's not natural.
No.
Oh, and it's not, it's not optimal and it's not required. But we sort of perpetuate this, we perpetuate out of not knowing, out of ignorance, this idea that, oh, but it's okay, we're all supposed, entrepreneurs are supposed to feel like they're not enough. It's like, no one's ever supposed to feel like they're not enough.
No, that's it. To be fair, there's a big like American personal development scene that's come from the late 80s and stuff that has actually promoted that, though, hasn't it? You've got Gary Vaynerchuk now, who's quite big on that, and it all serves a huge purpose. I appreciate Grant Cardone, even though I think you could probably put Tony Robbins into that there as well. I mean, I listened to a podcast with him with Russell Brand, and he's basically, he asked him, do you ever have a bad day? And Tony Robbins said no. Because if I feel bad, I change how I feel.
Yeah.
Which is great. Now, the average person sitting there is just going, I've got no idea how I do that, what I'm on about, what he's on about, anything. And to me, that's like, well, are you avoiding the problem or are you actually transcending the problem? What are you looking to do?
Mm-hmm. And like for me, I think, you know, Tony Robbins provides a great framework to stand on the shoulders of in terms of developing personal development and coaching. How can I say it? It's like they're almost there. It's like they're so close to it and yet really far away.
Mm-hmm.
And because they talk about like, oh, it's about it's about being. And so I choose my state and I manufacture, but it's like, yeah, but you're manufacturing your state.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, like love, peace, joy is the natural state. So why would you need to manufacture it?
Yeah.
It's just slightly sold backwards. Because there's this weak idea that there's something, you need to do something in order to get into a state of joy. You need to do something to get into a state of peace. Whereas that peace, love, joy is who you are and what you are. But also, again, it depends on your level of development. So you know, within that sort of spiral of development, within spiral dynamics, it's always true that who you are is the essence of peace, love, and joy.
Yeah.
And from a practical point of view, there also seems to be stages of brain development and society development that make it more or less easy to be able to access that kind of wisdom.
Yeah. So you've got Western culture there on that spiral. Because they use colours, don't they? Blue, orange, green, or blue, green, orange, whatever.
Yeah.
Where is Western culture? Because if I have to put my opinion onto that, I'd say the West actually has the most developed culture in the world. And I don't think we should be able to, you know, be scared to say that. That's why there's a lot of immigrants who want to come here and we don't want to go there. I don't think we should be, you know, scared to say that in any way, shape, or form. So where are the West on that spiral at the moment?
So the majority of Western culture is basically, so we're looking basically blue, orange, green.
Yeah, explain that a bit. Let's see where we go with that.
So basically, let's see what lenses we can look at here. So the Queen's Speech, for example, happened to watch the Queen's Speech in December. So she is the perfect example of tradition and blue thinking, okay? Which means, you know, there is absolute good and bad. Society is set up as a certain framework, which is the benefit of people, and you sacrifice something of yourself for the benefit of that society so that that society can run properly. Because that society was established out of a red paradigm, which was chaos, like violence, anarchy, violence, gang lords, or feudal lords, or this kind of stuff. So society and giving up part of our individuality to society is the price that we pay for this kind of sense of absolute peace. But that absolute peace is a kind of man-made moralistic framework. So, for example, so Jordan Peterson's book has been assessed as being 100% blue. You know, yeah. Here are the rules for life.
Yeah.
You show discipline here, here, and here, and the benefits of this are this, and you take your desires and you sort of suppress them in order to behave well and be a good citizen. Mm-hmm. Out of that, you then get orange culture emerges, which is scientific, materialistic, based success. If I stop playing the rules of society and I come up with my own ideas and I build this company and do this stuff, well, I'm going to end up with more and I'm going to have all of this impact and I'll be successful. So, you know, most entrepreneurialism is orange, technology is orange, Wall Street is the epitome of orange, sort of at its some of its most sort of extreme.
Would it be so very individualistic?
Incredibly individualistic, incredibly materialistic. It's all about the money. It's all about the stuff. It's all about like position and power and having more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
But the price that you often pay for that is your health, your well-being, your vitality, your fulfillment. So people often have all of this wealth, and then but they've got all of the symbols of it, but they're really miserable. So, like we spoke to someone last year, and you know they had their private jet, they had like four Teslas, and their family hates them. And so, you know, so within 20 minutes of of Jason speaking to this guy, he's like crying on his shoulder because, you know, he's got all of this stuff. He's got everything that he ever wanted and more, apart from what actually matters to him, really. Mm. Yeah, because he gave up his relationship. He messed about his family. He wasn't a great person. And you know, every time that he should reach out to his family and sort of find some way to like reconnect with them, he goes out and buys another Tesla.
Yeah.
And then the enjoyment of that lasts like 20 minutes or
whatever. That's where he's seeking connection, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. And so with Orange Society, we tend to put this materialism, and we forget that we have like a finite planet of resources. And so that leads into like green thinking, which is actual multiculturalism, right? So you know, we have at the moment, we have this issue whereas we have this thing of multiculturalism, but most multiculturalism as it's from in the West is just an attack on Western culture, rather than seeing that you can only attack Western culture from the yeah. point of view of using the foundation and the infrastructure that Western culture has created.
And growing upon it. Mm.
And people miss the foundation, seem to miss the foundation that they're standing on. You know, like things like, you know, you have like a lot of women's rights in the West, but like in the West, women have won pretty much. You know, I'm not saying things are perfect or that kind of stuff, but generally women have a lot of power and influence. There's still work to be done.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about, like, you know, the biggest game changer in terms of women moving out of violence globally is electricity. When electricity comes into towns and villages that didn't have it, women become empowered. They're able to go to work. They're not tied to this family tribal structure anymore. You know, and it's like, so sometimes you think, well, if you care so much about multiculturalism, don't spend loads of time in other cultures rather than just criticizing the one that we have. But on the positive side of sort of green thinking and the awareness of the environment is the awareness of the environment. So it is building in sustainability. It's building in this switch from the, you know, business being, so the point of business being to make profit, to the point of profit being to be a win for everyone and humanity and the planet.
Yeah.
So profit alone, without purpose, without mission, and without that mission being something that serves people, planet, environment, etc., starts to become like irrelevant and outdated. And that's, you know, so this move into green thinking is shown where things like, you know, 40% of consumers believe that companies and brands should be taking notable, practical, pragmatic steps towards solving humanity's biggest problems. And they want to see that happening for them to, you know, making purchase decisions, because so more and more people now make values-based purchase decisions rather than just, I just want that thing.
Yeah, consumeristic approach.
Yeah. And then you know, at the moment you have Scandinavia with their systems. So, you know, Norway, Sweden, Netherlands to a degree, they're effectively like green cultures. And in like the integral movement, so to speak, they're looking at that to see if they can shift from the what's called in spiral dynamics, or some people say that you have these colors of, you know, beige for survival, purple for sort of magical and tribal, red for some of ego, power development, you know, blue for authority, the state, the idea in you know, that there is just order and stability, you know, orange, materialism, growth, success, individualism, green, you know, community, environment, and then this shift into like integral, which is seeing that every point of view has validity and some are wiser than others. That there isn't, yes, you can have your own like belief systems, you can have your own, but there are like absolute truths and there are absolute principles. And those principles, no matter, it doesn't matter. Like you can sit there and go like, oh, well, I don't believe in gravity. It's like, well, cool, stop this pen falling from the ground.
Yeah, it's like a universal law. You can't get around that.
Yeah. It's and where you come into this stuff of like, you know, like equality, yes, we have sort of equality, so we can have like equal, you know, with men and women, there can be like equal opportunity, equal possibility and equal responsibility, which that bit often seems to get missed out.
Political
narrative. It's like, oh, you want, hold on, so you want equal opportunity, equal possibility, but you still want men to carry the can for everything. It's like, yeah. How's that working out for you? And but then also understanding that, you know, effectively, biologically, psychologically, lots of other ways, men and women are different. They're not the same.
Exactly right.
And while one individual may want to run, you know, run businesses, do this kind of thing, generally as a pattern, men and women tend to go towards certain.
Yeah, I think they've done tests in Scandinavia that sort of brought in like equality of outcome rather than equality of opportunity to see how that went.
Right.
I think it was stem cell research they did it in. And what they found is that there was hardly any men wanted to take that role, but because they were being forced down that route because of equality of outcome, they were getting mental health issues and all this. But actually, it was women who wanted to go more down that route and not men. But they thought it was going to be the other way. So it actually flipped on its head, completely different to what they thought it was going to be. So then they had to move back to equality of opportunity and not equality of outcome. Because I think it's a natural state of being that women naturally fall into one thing, men naturally fall into another. And I don't think it's up to the human mind to decide what they should and shouldn't be doing. They should let nature just take its course.
Yeah. And well, you give people the opportunity to try things out, you know? You give people the opportunity to access different things, to try different, you know, like experiments, to find the things that people love to do, that people want to do.
Yeah.
That they're going to, you know, because, you know, the simple, like a simple method of success is like find something that you enjoy and then you keep doing it because you enjoy it. And then because you enjoy it, you become really good at it. And because you're really good at it, you keep enjoying it, and then you become world class at it.
And
all that kind of stuff.
So in the spiral, we sort of started at blue because that's where, you know, most people are at. So you've got blue, that would be the monarchy. You've got orange, that would be, say, capitalism, Wall Street, as an example. Then you've got your greens, which would be maybe your hippies. Would that be right? And moving towards Scandinavia.
Yeah, hippies, but. Just environmental movement, sustainability movements, you know, things around human capital, value, mission-based businesses. These are all green, you know, taking orange and transitioning that into green.
Okay, so what's beyond green?
What's beyond green is integral.
Okay, so that's where you're at. That's where you're looking to move people and society.
Yeah. So one of the things in, say, a lot of NGO work, for example, and where a lot of that goes wrong is in people come in here with a Western way of thinking, and they sort of set up for people like, oh, we'll come and do this, and we'll do like, you know, we'll bring in like therapy and we'll bring in this. And the people down here is like, we need basic infrastructure. And because people can't see those, find it difficult to see those levels of development, and what people's actual needs are given their environmental conditions and their awareness. Mm. Like a lot of money and a lot of things gets wasted.
Okay.
So when you can, from an integral, when you start become integral, you start to see much more like, oh, hold on, these people need this. So something integral in Scotland, for example, was this thing of, I don't know if it's like 10 years ago, Scotland, well, still is known as the sick man of Europe. It has like the worst health, some of the worst violence rates. And so what they did is they reclassified violence, not as a personal issue, but as a health one. And they started to see it as a systematic problem. You know, based on conditions, environment, worldview, lack of education, lack of awareness, addiction, you know, traditional rough, you know, working class culture. And because they classified it as now as a disease, as a health issue, they've been able to come in and do all kinds of like interventions from a health point of view, from education point of view, and you know, the results is like the murder rate in Glasgow dropped by like 40%.
Wow.
in a few years.
That's powerful stuff.
Because you're taking it out of this, you know, from the orange worldview. You have this like, well, it's your responsibility. Mm. And you know, some people just don't have the developmental level to take responsibility for themselves. They haven't grown that far yet.
Mm.
So then you go come home and you say, well, you're being violent, it's all your responsibility. And they're like, this is like more.
Yeah.
And then you get the green thing and you're like, oh, we'll just give people compassion. It's like, you're great, but what about the tools and the infrastructure?
Yeah.
And then integral, you see, well, we have compassion because we can now see that this issue is a disease. It's a bigger issue than just an individual one. So we need to do like, you know, groundwork in terms of the, you know, the society, the terms of the system, and working on the individual as a whole person, and also working on their actual environment and situation. Because, you know, you take an addict from Liverpool or whatever, you go and rehab them, but then you go and put them back in the environment again, and most people will relapse.
Yeah.
So you need that. It's like you need the support on returning from your hero's quest to stabilize your new level of growth and development.
And we've mentioned this guy before, but Sri Aurobindo, I think he's got his own place in India, hasn't he, called Auroville. He wrote a book called Integral Yoga, was it?
He developed Integral Yoga.
Okay.
He developed Integral Yoga, which was basically a yoga without a system. So he basically said a lot of people, or a lot of the yoga practice of like, you do these asanas and you do these postures and you do this breathing and then you work through these stages up to become evolved and enlightened. And Aurobindo said, well, yes, there's this sort of development up of growing sort of like towards awareness, towards being more enlightened. And then he basically said, but there's this process of bringing that into or almost down from like this ultimate peace and love and integrating that into your body and your awareness regardless of what you're doing. So there's, you know, there's no special posture, there's no special thing, you know. And it's like this idea in a lot of, you know, spirituality that it's like, oh you run a business, how unenlightened of you.
Yeah,
and then you speak to some of these business people and the most switched on, aware, progressive, impactful people that you've ever met, but they've never done a yoga class.
Yeah.
And in life, and they're never gonna, because it's like they don't need to.
Mm.
And so, you know, Aurobindo was basically, and he also started off, again, you know, he started off with a very solid foundation of Western education.
Yeah, I think he went Cambridge or Oxford or something.
So he learned all the Western subjects.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, so he, you know, he's classically educated, you know, so he spoke English, French, probably Latin. And then he went back to India, having never spoken his mother tongue. So he learned himself his mother tongue. Then he taught himself Sanskrit. Then he led he was the first major leader of the Indian independence movement. But what he did was he didn't attack the British, he didn't attack the empire, but he called on the Indian people to start empowering themselves. And say, look, guys, we need to wake up, we need to grow up so that we can meet, so that we don't need these guys anymore.
Yeah.
So that we're responsible enough to be able to rule ourselves.
Which was opposite to Gandhi, wasn't it, in a way, where it was very passive?
Yeah.
Full compassion, full love. But in my opinion, Sri Aurobindo had gone past that to where we need to take a responsibility, a stand for ourselves. Let's grow ourselves.
Yeah, and he was also, like, you know, he was for peace, but he wasn't a pacifist.
Mm.
So Gandhi was against the British fighting Hitler, and Aurobindo was like, no, you've got to go to war with this guy
he's evil, man. You got to do it, yeah.
Exactly. There's no, like, you can't just. It's like, it's all very nice being able to go, like, peace, love, and connection, but. You know, whatever the circumstances and whatever role, say, the West plays in the development of ISIS, well, when you've got it there, you've got to go and deal with it, because they're actually, you know, they're creating, like, genuine terror for the people, and it was, you know, Western troops and soldiers a lot of the time that have gone in to sort that out.
Yeah.
And so you have to, like, you have to deal with conditions.
Yeah.
And that's also that factor in, you know, in spiral dynamics. It's like, well, it's all, you know, how are you now, but how are you going to be if, you know, if something happened in, you know, if the next recession comes next year and it's the worst recession in the entire of human history, and there's millions of people, like, unemployed and with no food, well, how are you going to be then? And, you know, are you still going to be able to be, like, this loving, kind, generous person when, you know, when other people are descending down to a much sort of baser, much more survival, panic-driven, fear-driven level?
Yeah.
Mm. And then how are you going to deal with that?
You see, we've got this spiral dynamics on lockdown.
What's that?
You've got this spiral dynamics on lockdown.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You have, mate. Down, put yourself down. Where can people find you and what you're up to?
Where can you find me? You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me at integral.me with my partner and colleague, Mr. Jason Grant, who is a genius in terms of system and company design, as well as Fresh Mind.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak. Personally, I've been through the Fresh Mind program. Made me contemplate a lot on certain things, helped me immensely over the last 4 or 5 months or so when I started. So you're highly recommended from myself. Anthony, thanks a lot for coming on. Time's up. So have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.
All the best, buddy. Bye-bye.
Cheers, mate.